Our next speaker is Nadav Drucker from the Niels Bohr Institute, and he's going to give us some comments on Wilson loops. Please.
Yes. Thank you, and I want to thank the organizers for inviting me to speak here. It's close to my future home and the other end of town. So I'm going to talk about Wilson loop operators, which I've studied extensively in the past few years. And those are very interesting gauge invariant operators in gauge theories in general, and they're non-local, and they're different from all the local operators, single trace local operators that were normally discussed here. And here is just the general form of a Wilson loop operator. We're going to make it slightly more complicated in a little bit, but there is a trace, the path ordering, and then the exponential of the holonomy around an arbitrary curve C. Now, usually one thinks of Wilson loops as a way to characterize the phases of a theory. And if you have two parallel lines, an infinite rectangle of separation r and length t, and you take the length t to infinity, the expectation value of the Wilson loop can be written as something that is proportional, exponent of something that is proportional to t, and then some function of r, and then measures the effective potential between the charged particles that make up this Wilson loop. And the main examples for the possible potentials that you get, V of R is 1 over R, which would be the case in this in N equals 4 gauge theory, which is conformal. Then if you have free electric charges, massless electric charges, you're going to get a log correction to it, and if you have magnetic charges, also the log is on the other side. If you're in the Higgs phase, you don't have the electric charges condense, and you have a screening, so you get a constant potential. And of course, in the confining theory, you have the string tension times the distance, and we all know that. And that's one of the main uses of Wilson loops. And for that, you take a large Wilson loop that can see these things. But in the case of N equals 4, that's not the question you want to ask. You know that the theory is conformal. But still, there are those observables in the theory, and you want to study them too, and you want to see how do you study them and what is their role. So one approach you can take is expanding them in terms of local operators. So any operator you can write is an expansion of local operators in the center. But this expansion is infinite, and every Wilson loop is made out of an infinite series of local operators. And unless you look at it from very, very far, this expansion doesn't seem to be very useful. And anyhow, you want to do something that is intrinsic to Wilson loops because they are such interesting and important operators. I don't want to resort to expanding them in terms of local operators. So that's the main motivation for my studies. And I'll continue by describing the relevant Wilson loops that we study in the N equals 4 gauge theory that have some supersymmetry. And then I will try to see what are the calculations we want to do. And actually, there is still a lot of confusion in my head. What should we calculate? Should we calculate the expectation value of Wilson loops? Should we calculate the correlator of two Wilson loops or more? Stuff like that. And I'll present some ways of organizing the calculations. And the first thing I will do is I'll start by classifying them by the amount of supersymmetry they have. So I'll start with half BPS loops. And there are two of them, an infinite straight line and a circle. And I'll say a few words about how you calculate them in perturbation theory. Then I'll say how you calculate them in ADS using strings, and also mention D3 brains and D5 brains. The light green here is so you can't see it very well, because I'm going to have to go over this very, very fast because I don't have enough time. Yes? Yes. Then I'll also quickly mention some quarter BPS loops where there are some new results that are interesting. And so that is one way of organizing the calculation, doing some type of calculation, and we can get some results that seem to be exact. And then I'll switch gears and concentrate mainly on this part, which are non-supersymmetric Wilson loops. So same way that people started studying BPS local operators and then realized that we can actually study non-BPS local operators by spin chains, I'll do the same thing for Wilson loops, and then I'll see which types of Wilson loops I can study in this way. And that will be, again, a very restricted family, but that may be the direction to go. So I have here a few directions to go, but this will be the main thing I'm going to concentrate on, how to derive spin chains out of Wilson loop operators. So what are the Wilson loop operators that we have? So in n equals 4, in addition to the gauge field, there are also scalars and fermions, and we may include them in the Wilson loop. And here I have a gauge field in the exponent, and I also have one of the scalar fields, phi I, or any arbitrary combination of the scalar fields. And in principle, you can also add the spinners, but I won't do that. And x mu is an arbitrary path, and theta is an arbitrary coupling to the scalars. And I'll mention BPS in the next slide, I guess. Now, when you want to calculate this thing in ADS, this little x and theta provide the boundary condition on the string in ADS. So Wilson loop is calculated in terms of a classical macroscopic string extending to the boundary of ADS. And the little x provides Dirichlet boundary condition on four coordinates in ADS, while the theta provide Neumann boundary conditions that are related to the S5 directions. And then the expectation value for the Wilson loop in ADS is given by the path integral over the string action with these boundary conditions, and you usually approximate it by the classical saddle points. So, did I? Oh yeah, it did say here about supersymmetry. Sorry. So, if it's reasonably easy to see that if the coupling here, the size of the coupling to the scalar and the gauge field is equal, this operator preserves some of the supersymmetry at that point of, in space-time. Basically, the projector associated, you take the combination, well, the supersymmetry variation will give you some projector which will include two terms, and when the coefficient of those two terms is equal, it will have some zero eigenvalues. But that is a local supersymmetry, and you can also get a global supersymmetry if you take this to be a constant, and this is dying, and if you take the gauge field to be in a constant direction and the scalar to be in a constant direction, then the supersymmetry is global, and this straight line Wilson loop is annihilated by some combination of the Qs and the Q bars and preserves half the supercharges. So if the vacuum has the PSU224 symmetry, this Wilson loop preserves a subgroup which is of this form. 4 star here is some funny real form of SO4, which instead of having two SU2 factors has an SL2 and an SO3, and the SP4 is an SO5. So this is the subgroup that is preserved by this Wilson loop. This is the bosonic part of it. Now, the SO5 is easy to see. Those are the rotations of all the scalars that are not number 6. SO3 are rotations around the line. Around the line in 4 dimensions, you have an S2, which has an SO3 symmetry of rotations. And SL2R are the conformal symmetries on the line. They include the time translation, the dilatation, and a special conformal transformation. So that's one half BPS Wilson loop. By conformal transformation, you can map any line to a circle. And here I have the circular Wilson loop, where psi is an angular direction. And the radius of the circle is r. So this will also preserve half the supersymmetries, but different combination of supersymmetries. Because we did a large conformal transformation, some of the q's are going to be replaced by s's and s bars. So this is now annihilated by some combination involving q's, q bars, s, and s bars. So it's a little bit more difficult now to see this group, but it's still there. So for now, I'm going to concentrate a little bit on this Wilson loop itself and study it. But in a little bit, I will go over to study deformations of this Wilson loop. And that is the thing that will be described by spin chain. And the reason you can do it is that this operator preserves this supergroup, which includes a non-compact part, the SL2R. And so a deformation of this will be given by representations of this group. In particular, the representations of SL2R will be they're going to be standard representations of SL2R, and they have a continuous label, which we can call the conformal dimension, and those will be the analog of the conformal dimension of local operators. But these are not local operators, because there is still an SL2R symmetry for the Wilson loop, the deformations of the Wilson loop may have something that we can call a conformal dimension. So let me just go very briefly over how you calculate this Wilson loop in perturbation theory. So you expand it to a one loop order. You get a 1. Then you expand the exponent of the Wilson loop and you get the contraction of 2 A's. Then you get the contraction of 2 scalars. And then something miraculous happens, that the propagator has in the denominator a factor of the distance, sine squared of the relative angle over 2. And in the numerator, you get this will be just a constant, minus 1. And here you are going to get the relative angle between them, the tangent vectors to the two circles. That's the direction of these gauge fields. And that's cosine psi 2 minus psi 1. And this turns out to be a constant, just a half. And this was noticed by my chairman and Kostia and Eriksson, and that the propagator is a constant. And this allows you to sum up all ladder diagrams. On top of that, they also checked that at 2 loops, the interacting graphs vanish. So that gives you some reason to expect the ladder diagrams to be, might give you the full answer. So since the propagators are a constant, you have no spatial dependence. You can reduce the problem to 0 dimensions. And then all you have is the combinatorics of these graphs, which can be expressed in terms of a zero-dimensional Hermitian matrix model. So here I have the action, the Gaussian action of a matrix M, which gives me the propagator that I had in the previous transparency. Now I have an observable trace e to the M, which mimics the Wilson loop. And that should be the expectation value of the Wilson loop. So this is the result for all the ladder diagrams. And then you can calculate it, and the simplest way is to go to, if you just want the planar result, then this is given by the Wigner distribution, the semicircle law, And here is, again, my... So this is the distribution of eigenvalues. And here is my the operator whose expectation value I'm calculating. And this is a Bessel function. And this Bessel function at large lambda behaves like e to the square root of lambda. Now, you can actually do much better than that and calculate this matrix model exactly. And one interesting regime you can calculate is when you take a Wilson loop multiply wrapped k times, where k is proportional to n. And then you get another result, dependent on kappa, which is a ratio of k to n times square root of lambda. And this starts off as e to the square root of lambda, but then includes an infinite series of corrections in 1 over n squared. And we will be able to reproduce this from string theory. So, how do you calculate the Wilson loop in string theory? Well, if we take this metric for ADS5, where this is R4, you need to find a surface that satisfies the boundary conditions specified before. For the line, it is just the surface spanned by the coordinate y and t. And then the action is just the integration over these variables and 1 over y squared, the conformal factor in the metric. And this diverges, but you have to add a boundary term which cancels this divergence, and you get that the action is 0, which gives you that the expectation value of the Wilson loop is 1, which is also the result from perturbation theory at low orders. For the circle, the result is the calculation is a little bit more complicated. You have the solution is y squared plus r squared is equal to a constant, where r is a radial coordinate in the plane where the circle is sitting. And then you calculate the action, and you get some different answer. And again, it diverges, like with a y naught, some cutoff on y, and then a constant minus 1 times square root of lambda. So this divergent piece will again cancel, and you're left with a minus square root of lambda, and you get that the expectation value of the Wilson loop is e to the square root of lambda, which is the result that we got also from the matrix model. So that is a nice result for the circular Wilson loop. The more recently, the Wilson loop was calculated also by D3 brains and D5 brains. So those are the analog of giant gravitons for Wilson loops. And I won't go over the calculation in detail, but you can find D3 brains and D5 brains that preserve the relevant symmetry and have the correct boundary conditions. And those should also represent and carry electric fluxes. So they also represent something like Wilson loops. And they turn out to be related to Wilson loops in representations of dimension k, where k is of order n. And it seems like the D3 brain is the multiply wrapped Wilson loop, a multiply wrapped k times, and the D5 brain is the anti-symmetric representation of dimension k. And I mentioned before how you calculate it in the gauge theory, and there were since then some very accurate calculations in the gauge theory or in the matrix model. And calculating the action in string theory is a little bit subtle, again, because of divergences and about the boundary terms, but we think we sort of know how to do it, and we get a finite answer. Here I have a picture of, I tried to make a picture of what one of those D3 brains will look like. So if you think of a circle here on the boundary, the D3 brain shrinks to the circle, but then it blows up into some extra directions as you go away from the boundary. So you get this funny kind of surface. The intrinsic geometry is of ADS2 cross S2. And the geometry of the D5 brain is ADS2 cross S4. Now, what you get by doing the D3 brain calculation, calculating the Dirac-Bornfeld action, you get the same result that I wrote before that you get in the, from the matrix model for large k, where kappa was proportional to k. And this is proportional to e to the square root of k, sorry, k times square root of lambda, which would be just the result of k strings, each of them with tension square root of lambda, plus corrections like this, plus an infinite series of corrections in 1 over n squared, as I mentioned. And this is exactly reproduced between the Dirac-Bornfeld action and the matrix model calculation. Same thing happens with the anti-symmetric representation and the D5 brain. So that's quite strong tests of the ADS-CFT and of this half BPS Wilson loop calculation. So this is a really nice operator, and we know how to calculate it. And this should illustrate that there is some integrable system behind it, but it is not very similar to the integrable systems that we've been talking about here during this conference. I don't really have time to describe the quarter BPS loop, but Zarembo had a construction of a large family of Wilson loops that can have an arbitrary amount of supersymmetry, a quarter, an eighth, or 1/16, depending on where the path goes in R4. If it's restricted to a plane, then you can concoct scalar couplings, so it's always quarter BPS. If it moves in an R3, then you can always preserve 1/8. And if in all of R4, it can be 1/16. And they all have trivial expectation values and all are annihilated by the Qs and the Q bars. But you can also find more complicated Wilson loops, and I don't have time to describe it, that is a quarter BPS and interpolates between the half BPS example circle that I explained and that I just described before and the quarter BPS one of Zarembo. And so there is an infinite family of quarter BPS, and they all preserve different combinations of the Qs and the Ss. The really weird thing about this family of Wilson loops is that they also seem to be given by a matrix model, if you do the calculation in perturbation theory, up to two loops, with the only replacement of the coupling going to cosine squared theta times the coupling, where theta naught is an arbitrary parameter in the solution. And then if you calculate it in ADS, you get the same contribution from the ADS 5 part, but now there's also contribution from S5, where you wrap part of an S2. And this part of the S2 exactly gives you the ADS 5 part gives the same as before. The part of the S2 gives you this contribution, and together you get square root of lambda cosine squared theta naught. So it agrees exactly with the same replacement that we had in the gauge theory. Even more than that, there are actually two solutions, because I could have wrapped the surface over the southern hemisphere instead of the northern hemisphere. So I have two contributions in principle, and one of them is unstable, with plus minus square root of lambda prime. And actually, this matches the gauge theory result, because the gauge theory had the Bessel function, and the Bessel function has the asymptotic expansion of the Bessel function has two contributions, e to the square root of lambda and e to the minus square root of lambda. So those two saddle points, including the unstable one, are given by the gauge theory calculation. And you can see that it's unstable because there is an imaginary. This term is imaginary. So again, I'm saying this. Let me just mention this also, which is something I'm a little bit puzzled about. That we can then take a BMN-like limit where we keep lambda large, but take the combination that I had before, lambda cosine squared theta naught, to be small. And I don't exactly understand the meaning of this limit, but it means that in string theory, the string theory calculation at large lambda will be identical to the perturbation theory in the gauge theory, the same thing that you have in the BMN limit. But I'm not sure whether this is a general thing or it's just this specific example where it works. And then you can get from integrating over the zero modes of the solution, you can get the full Bessel function, the full planar result. So I'll finish the first part of my talk by saying that for these supersymmetric Wilson loops, there are some very interesting results, and there are some still many examples that have not been studied. There are still many, many more types of Wilson loops that are supersymmetric but involve the S's and can have very special properties. And the special class of Wilson loops, we can calculate their expectation values and get and seem to get exact results that are quite interesting. So now let me shift gears and talk about more general loops, non-supersymmetric. And now we need some way of classifying them and studying them. And for that I start with... So first... If I study them in ADS, it actually seems to be quite easy to study arbitrary Wilson loops. So a Wilson loop is given by a classical solution to the sigma model, a minimal surface. And since the sigma model is classically integrable, I can do this. So any given any boundary conditions, in principle, I can find a surface that will satisfy this boundary condition and calculate its action and get the expectation value of the Wilson loop. So in principle, you can do this for all Wilson loops. In practice, we did it for Wilson loops with periodic couplings, like a circle or a helix or stuff like that, and then periodic couplings also to the scalars. And then we reduced the problem to a one-dimensional integrable system and solved it. Still, the solution is quite complicated, and you find generally a large number of solutions for a given set of boundary conditions. One example is the one I had before for the quarter BPS one, where we had two solutions, but in general, you have an infinite number of solutions to the equations of motion. So the story is quite complicated, but in principle, it's doable. The equations of motion are integrable, and you should just integrate them and fix the boundary conditions and do that. But on the gauge theory side, that's what I started to say before, this doesn't seem to work. If you take an arbitrary Wilson loop and you start calculating it, you get a mess. So we need some organizational principle, and then we start by looking at the ones we understand, the circle or the line. And as I said before, they preserve an SL2R group, and therefore the deformations of the circle or the line are going to be given by representations of SL2R. And SL2R is non-compact. It has continuous labels, the representations. So there is the potential of something depending on the coupling in these deformations of the Wilson loop. So here I have the Wilson loop, which is the circle. And I added a bunch of insertions in front. Each of those is a word combination of the operators in the theory that is in the adjoint. And they're connected to each other by this Wilson loop and made gauge invariant. So here I have some examples. So this what I'm calculating now is the expectation value of a circle or a line with a bunch of insertions, and this can be thought of as a small deformation of the circle of the, or the line. But I can also think about this as the two or three or endpoint function of adjoint operators. If I take these adjoint operators, put them on the circle or the line, and I connect them with a Wilson loop, And then I have a gauge invariant quantity. So this is a way of defining the endpoint function of a gauge-dependent adjoint fields. And because of this SL2R symmetry of the Wilson loop, these operators will satisfy all the axioms of conformal field theories. So the two-point functions will depend only on the distance. The three-point function will involve the structure constants, and again, the distance dependence will be fixed by the dimensions. And you can go on to four-point functions and so on. So while in ADS I was able to calculate just about any Wilson loop I wanted, other gauge theory, the easy calculations are the circle or a line with a finite numbers of insertions in them, of local insertions into them. And here I will concentrate on just two insertions, and I will further restrict to them being two of those scalars. So what I will get will be something related to the SU2 spin chain. So when I have a two-point function, it's important to go through the derivation of what is normally done with a conformal field theories. There is a word identity related to in the case of the line, to dilatation invariance. So I have the Wilson loop with two insertions into it, and because of dilatation invariance, this is zero, which means that the two-point function has this structure, 1 over the the distance between the two insertions to the twice the dimension. And same is true for the circle. This is the distance after I rescale it by some power of r. And by the usual argument, this means that all divergences that you get in the perturbative calculation of this expression will come from renormalization of these dimensions. So this establishes the notion of a dimension for these adjoint operators inserted into the Wilson loop. So how do I calculate it in practice? Well, at tree level, I just take two operators. Here I drew them with three letters each. Here, say, three Z's. Here, three Z bars. This is the Wilson loop. And a convenient gauge, the Wilson loop will not contribute at all, and you're just going to get the non-local trace of those two operators. And you know that that is going to be some number divided by the distance to the sixth. So the classical dimension is just going to be one for every, it's just going to be the length of every one of those words. That is quite simple. Now, I want to interpret it as a spin chain. And again, what I have, I'm going to take the large n limit, so you have just planar contractions. And what you get is, just from looking at the graphs, you immediately see that the result will be an open spin chain, because each of those words had a beginning and an end. And this one can only be contracted with that one. This one can only be contracted with that one. This one can only be contracted with that one. No cyclicity. There is no cyclic symmetry because there is just a single trace around the entire thing. So at tree level, it's an open spin chain, which just gives you a delta function identifying the two words. But it's also obvious that at higher loops, this will be an open spin chain. The question is, which spin chain is it? So here I have some of the graphs at one loop, and you can see that the bulk interactions are just going to be the same bulk interactions that you get in the normal case. You have the interaction between nearest neighbors, or this interaction, or the self-energy graph. And these All these lines in the interior will not know anything about the Wilson loop. And here I wrote what these graphs contribute. The only difference from the normal spin chain is that the external lines, this one and this one, cannot talk to each other, the two external lines, because they're the two ends of the spin chain and there is no cyclicity. But they can talk to the Wilson loop, so there are graphs like this of a gluon exchange between this scalar and the Wilson loop, or between this scalar and the Wilson loop. And they give you some kind of some contribution, which is a number. So adding up all these graphs, you get a Hamiltonian, which at one loop is just the one minus permutations of all the guys in the middle without the external one. So you see the sum here ends at k minus 1. Usually it goes up to k, where k plus 1 is identified with 1. So this is just the interaction between, just the exchange between the internal ones, and nothing really interesting happening at the boundary. So this is the most simple boundary conditions you can impose on the Heisenberg spin chain. And it's very, very simple to solve it, because if you take a spin chain of double length and impose a reflection invariance, then automatically the interaction between the k and k plus 1 site will cancel, because 1 minus p then will be equal to 0, and also between the 1 and the 2k site will also cancel. So what you get is that this open spin chain is equal to this closed spin chain after imposing reflection symmetry. So any solution of the usual closed spin chain that is reflective invariant around the middle will be also a solution of the open spin chain. So how much time do I have? Okay. Well, you go through the normal procedure. You define the magnon as a state like this, where k has an x at the kth position. And I already wrote here the correct shift that you need to do in the momentum. And it's the rapidity down there. And then what you get is, this is the Vela equations, where now you have here double the terms, which is standard for an open spin chain. And you can get it automatically if you look at the doubled spin chain, where now you can see that you have your power of 2k, where I assume I have k excitations. I take k excitations and k images, so I have 2k. And this is the scattering of the excitations and of their images. So I have double the scatterings. And these are the anomalous dimensions, as usual. And for a single impurity, it's very simple to solve. That is, a single, in this case, for the open spin chain, you can have a single impurity, which is the same as two impurities for the closed chain, and this is the energy, as usual, sine squared, with a numerical factor here, slightly different. So we want to calculate this also in string theory, and I can use the same techniques that I used, that I said before, that I can calculate for just about any Wilson loop. I can use it also in this case. And now we want a Wilson loop that carries some charges. There are z and z bar insertions into it, so it should involve some rotation around the sphere. And for that, it's useful to use global ADS, where you put the z insertion at past infinity and the z bar insertion at future infinity. So here is the metric of global Lorentzian ADS. And here is a picture of it. No, where's the picture? Here's the picture. Here is the picture. So this is global IDS. This is the sphere. And I have a Wilson loop going from the past up to the future and then back along an antipodal point on S3. If you go back to Euclidean IDS, these two lines going up and down are mapped to a circle, a great circle, on S4. And here I have a Z insertion in the past and a Z bar insertion in the future, which means that around here, the world sheet should rotate around the S5. Well, at the boundary, it couples to another scalar, which means it's at the North Pole. So the boundary of the world sheet is mapped to the North Pole. The middle of the world sheet is mapped to the equator and is rotating around. And that is described by this solution. So it's an exact solution, and it's simple. Quite standard in these games. Then the center here of the world sheet on the sphere and on IDS is where the BMN regime lives. And you can zoom in on it. And you can study the theory in that limit and reproduce the spectrum that we calculated from the gauge theory. So in that case, let me go back. I drew here a region that will be the BMN space. So you see that my string crosses it entirely. So what I have is a macroscopic string inside the BMN, inside the PP wave metric, and it extends all the way to infinity in the PP wave. And it has infinite action, but that's okay. I'm not worried about that. That is renormalized. I have to study the fluctuations of it. And the fluctuations of it are pretty much just the fluctuations of open strings. So same spectrum as you get for closed strings, you get for open strings, just the modes have a different quantization condition, different by a half, and this is the spectrum that you get in the PP wave, and you get this in the limit of large J, which is the same as I found for the single magnon spectrum in the gauge theory. So that agrees. You can go further and study the gauge theory, the open spin chain in the thermodynamic limit, and the string theory solutions with two angular momenta, and it gets quite intricate, the solutions of the string theory equations of motion, because you have to involve five of the coordinates, so it's no longer even elliptic functions. But there is a way of doing it, and On the gauge theory side, first, what you need to do is take a large number of excitations that condense into beta strings, and this was done in the case of the closed spin chain, and luckily the people that did it in the case of a closed spin chain already took configurations that were symmetric around the imaginary axis. So those are automatically solutions also to our system. They satisfy the projection needed in our orb folding. So all the difference on the H theory side is to account for some factors of two, which we did. And this is the results. And if you ever did it in the gauge theory, this will look slightly familiar. So on the string theory side, what you get is a similar picture to the one I had before, where you start on ADS, it will be exactly the same thing, but here you need to move on not only on an S2, but inside an S4. But what you have, first you move exactly as it is here, from the North Pole to the equator of an S2, and then you start moving away from this point into the other direction. When you're exactly in the middle of ADS, you move in the other direction and then back again to the other boundary. And the equations that you find in this case, in this regime close to the center, are exactly the same equations as for a folded string. Those are the solutions that, those are some of the string solutions that carry two angular momenta. And what happens here is that because you're connecting here to the boundary, well, all you have is just half of a folded string. A folded string is a string that goes somewhere between two points and then back along itself. What happens here is that you just have these two points and then you connect it here in the middle and then connect it through the rest of the solution to the boundary. And then when you calculate the quantum numbers carried by this solution, at the order that we calculated them for large quantum numbers, those are half of the folded strings, because it is just half of a folded string. And this exactly agrees with the solution of the beta equations in the thermodynamic limit. So I told you that there we have half of the spin chain. Here we have half of the folded string, and the two exactly agree with each other. So this is just about what I wanted to say. And I will repeat that there are many, many Wilson loops, and I do not know exactly which one should be studied and how they should be studied and what is the organizational principle that should be employed. And I used two. One is supersymmetry, and the other one is small deformations of the circle, and using the SL2R symmetry to study them. And maybe there are other ways of organizing the calculation, calculating more things. The circle and the line have this SL2 that allow you to define a CFT, and that CFT has the conformal dimensions that allowed me to study deformations. You have the anomalous dimensions. Now, what is funny about those two different calculations here, in this case, I calculated the dimension of the operator, delta, here. In the case of the supersymmetric Wilson loops, what I did not have anything here in the denominator. What I calculated was the expectation value, this normalization, this number here. But usually it's something you do not calculate. It's something quite hard to calculate. But in this case, it seemed to be easy. So it looks like these two things calculate two different properties of Wilson loops, and I don't know which one is really interesting and which one should be studied. Another thing I mentioned was that the Wilson loop seems to be described by the Gaussian matrix model, which is remarkably rich and seems to know about D3 brains and D5 brains and strings and just about everything you have in ADS. So it's a very rich system. And it's the Gaussian matrix model also describes a quarter BPS loop, seems to be, and allows you to take some kind of BMN limit. And then there are many, many more things I still plan to do. So thank you.
Other questions? Well, maybe while you're thinking, I have a question. Is there any hint in all of this at a real Norway normalization theorem for the circle or straight line Wilson loop?
Well, I always thought it would come out of special properties of half BPS, but now that I find it to also work for quarter BPS, I'm more confused about that. Has much less symmetry. It doesn't have the SL2R symmetry, the quarter BPS one, and it actually makes me more confused as to why it works, because it works in more cases. So No, I mean, in the case of the half BPS, I have some extra reasons to think that the symmetry might impose it, but in the case of the quarter BPS, I have no idea.
Other questions?
I have one.
Please. So you were talking about the half-folded string, and so the folded string in normal ADS just goes from the minus past, from the past to the future, but doesn't connect to the boundary.
Yes.
How do you connect it to the boundary here?
Okay, so this is a folded string inside S5, but that really doesn't matter. The folded string, what you do is you take, you have two branches of the solution that you connect at the endpoints. And you take one branch and then you connect to another copy of it oriented in the other way.
Yes.
Instead of connecting those two branches, you connect it to a Wilson loop that extends to a string that extends to the boundary. Now, that would normally not work because the equations of motion force it to fold. But because of a... So it cannot happen... In the conformal gauge, it cannot happen at finite time on the world sheet. Mm-hmm. But at infinite time on the world infinite distance on the world sheet, those two solutions can actually connect in a way that will extend it to the boundary. Mm-hmm. This is an approximation. The full solution involves the exact solution involves a solution to hyperelliptic. They're hyperelliptic and not elliptic functions. But it's a good approximation just to take the folded string and glue it to the rest of the string connecting to the boundary.
Okay. I think I was interested also in the case. If you look at some strings which go from the past to the future and sort of reach a point in the future or reach a finite size object, does that make sense? I mean, I'm just wondering if the spectral curves for these objects are distinguished in some way for strings that correspond to local operators and for strings that correspond to Wilson.
I don't think. They are not distinguishable in that this is extra information, the fact that they reach the boundary. In the usual study of these objects, you assume that the topology is the cylinder, and then they don't reach the boundary. If you allow them to reach the boundary, then you have many, many more solutions with the same quantum numbers. And these are these objects.
Okay, thank you.
Other questions?